knows there's a, or maybe everyone already has, the lesson plan on the back table back there. I don't think I've corrected it yet for the lesson. I'm sorry, for the spring series. I think that was moved up or moved back a week, wasn't it? The spring series. So it may not be corrected for that, but they're in the right order anyway. So we're back on track this week. At least after this week, we'll be back on track. We picked up now with Rome, which, as you recall, was kind of early in our series. The Roman administration and military. This somehow is a difficult lesson to put together. I think I find that I discover things interesting that I don't seem to think would be all that applicable to our study. And so I find myself cutting all those pieces out, and what I end up with is this Swiss cheese of a lesson left over that doesn't have any coherence in terms of order, in terms of, it's just not filled out. So I try to keep the dry recitation of data and facts to a minimum, and so I think we just may make it. So we're on our final of our four series here. Again, as we've expressed, we don't have any explicit identification of the fourth beast or the legs of iron and the toes of iron and clay. Either in Daniel 2 or in Daniel chapter 7, there's nowhere that we know of that the Lord refers back to this and says this is that time, in a sense. You know, we have obviously indirect hints and indirect arguments that I think we can establish that pretty clearly, but you know, you don't have to go far from the tree to find alternate interpretations of that. So we've identified this as the Roman Empire, as the fourth kingdom. This kingdom where, if you look at this statue as a timeline, with the top being Babylon, and the bottom being whatever kingdom it is that this rock made without hands strikes this statue in the feet. The location where the statue is struck, to me, indicates something of a timeline, something of a chronology. This statue is progressing forward in time as you go down the length of it. So in my mind, I see that as identifying the statue in the legs and in the feet as occurring in the time when the kingdom was established. And we believe the kingdom be established in the first century, and it's kind of a deduction to reason that this is talking about Rome. So enough of that. Rome is a city which we don't look at in detail. I couldn't even have told you off the top of my head what the seven hills of Rome were, but we all know that Rome has seven hills, and I won't try to pronounce them all. Isn't Latin a dead language anyway, right? We probably don't even know how it was pronounced. And as we saw, this city is seemingly very far away. Even in the narrative, it seems to exist way out there. Rome does, and similarly with the emperor, it seems to exist way out there, and it truly is a long way away in the measure of ancient travel. And we've seen this map a couple times again, from here, Rome to say a port city of Caesarea is the line that's drawn out here, and this shows a journey by sea of about 20 days. So as the crow flies, I think I show this is 1,500 miles. But of course, you can't travel from Rome to Judea as the crow flies in this day and age. You know, nowadays we could strike a line and fly it, something like that, I suppose. But in those days, they had, you know, the option of travel by sea, by various routes. I guess there's just one shown here, and travel by land, which may involve a sea journey to Greece, and maybe a sea journey to Asia, and then a land trip, or it may involve, if you had an entire legion to move, they actually had improved roads that would run this entire length, which we'll see. So when we speak about the Gospel Age in the first century and how it was this confluence of circumstances and conditions and prophecies and just all this backdrop of the Gospels, oftentimes unspoken and really unidentified, it just seems to be there. As again, we see Rome as this distant place, but it exercises such control before and during the time of the Gospels. It just seems to provide this almost transparent, invisible backdrop. So we speak of the ease of travel by land and sea in the Roman Empire, and the corresponding speed of communication, the corresponding volume of trade. However, sea travel could be dangerous. I mean, this is a 20-day trip, and that would be in the best of circumstances. During a sea voyage to Rome on a ship with 600 persons, Josephus experiences a shipwreck and in which all but 80 die. And Paul himself tells of a shipwreck, in which there were 276 people on board, in which none of them died. So it's kind of interesting percentage there when you think about the providence that was working on Paul's behalf there. And as I say, the Romans themselves had constructed a series of improved roads over the entire empire. In fact, they had over 50,000 miles of improved roads. And these are not just, you know, goat paths and unimproved gravel or mud roads. Many of these roads we know about because they still exist. They're still there. We can still document the length of them and where they were. But these were carefully engineered, painstakingly constructed roads. And they're constructed with a. In this case, you know, these roads are so old that they may not still reflect some of these features. But these roads were constructed with an arch or with a crown in them to shed water like a turtle. They were constructed with gutters on both sides to prevent runoff from eroding and destroying the road over time. These roads were the first roads to permit travel during and immediately after inclement weather. At the slowest, the roads permitted travel on foot at about 35 miles a day, which doesn't sound like much. And at the fastest, a courier could travel 550 miles in about a week. So about 500 miles a week they could travel. But as I said, many of these are still improved thoroughfares, are still major thoroughfares for modern vehicles, and the quality of the road is essentially unsurpassed until the invention of macadamized roads back in the 19th century. So there was no improvement on the technology over the years. And I have here a cross section of how complicated the system was, and it's not just that they just threw in there what they had. They had to actually filter and sort out materials and assemble them in a certain order. And hew out sometimes stones, both on the top and on the bottom, to create this profile that they wanted. In this case, this is a road in Pompeii. It's in a city, so it has sidewalks on both sides, and that road is still there. So certainly, the roads were good for commerce. They were certainly good for communication. But why? Why were they built? What were the purpose of them? I mean, is that just out of the goodness of their hearts? They just saw that, well, we want to have a prosperous empire and we want to get access to all these places and we want fast communication? Well, if you look at take a closer look at the road, at this map that's been prepared of the roads, these red lines representing the roads, the highways that the Romans had constructed across the empire, we'll see that I circled here. Several places, there's more than I've circled actually, but I have circled four, one, two, three, four, which are locations where a Roman legion was stationed at one time or another. This would represent the Roman legion around AD 70. There was no Roman legion, no Roman legion was permanently stationed in Jerusalem for most of the early empire. But I've circled here the Legion 5, Legion 10, Legion 12, and Legion 15. We'll talk a little bit more about 12. That's one that that we mentioned in that was mentioned in the lesson last week by Tom. And And these were stationed at various locations around the empire, and they had to be able to get from one place to another in a hurry. And that was really why they were built. They were really built for military purposes. And these other benefits that were seen from them were really incidental. And incidentally, the primary benefit that we recognized was the speed at which the gospel was spread away from Jerusalem. It says that a Roman legion can move at about 4 miles per hour, an entire legion of Roman soldiers, which is an incredible speed when you think about it in terms of being able to traverse the empire with something on the order of 5,000 to 6,000 men in a legion. Probably the most important circumstance provided by the empire is something that is kind of a non-condition or a non-feature, and that is the Roman peace. It was essentially the absence of conflict, the absence of war. It was called the Pax Romana. It was actually had a name. It was actually something that Augustus marketed to the empire. He had this, you know, he would close the doors to the temple Janus, which was the god of war. And when the doors were closed, it was peacetime, and the doors stayed closed for something like 40 years. So that was kind of obviously there was no re-election as an emperor, but that was kind of his claim to fame in a sense that he could keep these doors shut and there'd be no threat to the mainland, essentially the mainland of Italy primarily. And that lasted for several hundred years. The Pax Romana theoretically lasted, or technically did for the Romans. Obviously it didn't last that long for Judea. But the Romans regarded peace not as an absence of war, but the rare situation that exists when all opponents have been beaten down beyond the ability to resist. So that's essentially what peace meant, and that's what these legions stationed around the empire ensured was this peace. It was ensured by these citizen armies, which we'll get into. But even this peace, as kind of arbitrary or as kind of contrived as it might be, militarily speaking, is, I think, a peace that is presaged by the prophets. And it's, as we'll see, this was kind of a, in a future lesson, we talk about how that the time of the gospel was a time that was a time that was in the fullness of time, essentially. In Genesis 49:10, it says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." This Shiloh is sometimes interpreted as the one who brings peace, or the one who is the giver of peace. And certainly, we don't think the Rome is that obviously, but the fact that peace exists at this time when Shiloh comes is a context and kind of a part of the environment in which the Messiah arrives in. It's this peaceful, quiet time in this empire. And it is announced by the angels to the shepherds at the birth of Jesus. Glory to God in the highest, and peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Again, not specifically speaking of the Roman Pax Romana, but still, the time period of Christ's life and the time period of his ministry was marked by peace. And that was his stated purpose, essentially, was not to bring judgment and violence at that time, but to bring about repentance, to have this time when men could stop and contemplate and repent, and this time of essentially a mercy, essentially, the long suffering of God is mercy. So how did the Romans maintain this peace? You know, we've already seen that this was obviously accomplished by these legions which were stationed around the empire, but essentially it amounted to an administration. Did I miss a slide here? Okay. It essentially amounted to an administration, a top-down administration, a monarchy essentially, on the face of it, controlled by the emperor, by Caesar. Of course, as you all I'm sure are well aware, the Roman citizens have this aversion to a monarchy, essentially, so-called. And so the emperors found it convenient to and expedient to maintain the Senate as an operational and as kind of a public arm of the empire. It was never it was not intended to be explicit, but it was, you know, obviously the senators understood it. By the time Julius Caesar had taken control of Rome and what was essentially the Roman Empire, the senators realized that they were essentially existing at the at the will of the empire of the emperor. But still, the Senate had an important part in this administration, and outside of the mainland of Rome, there was not this aversion to the monarchy, and it was commonly referred to in that language. Even at the trial of Jesus, the chief priests readily acknowledged the Caesars as kings, essentially. "We have no king but Caesar." That's the response when Pilate asked them, "Shall I crucify your king?" Well, speaking of Pilate, let's get into who these governors were, how it was that Rome exercised control. I mean, obviously Caesar didn't micromanage all these little provinces all over this empire. And as we saw previously, the emperors commonly would use these local kings and provincial magistrates to rule. You know, the Herods were an example of that. The Hasmoneans were an example of that. But there were three main types of provincial governors who all were Roman citizens, and both the proconsuls and the propraetors were actually former senators. They weren't appointed by a senator, only the proconsul was appointed by a senator. But the emperor essentially could appoint the propraetors or the procurators, as they would eventually be called by the time of Claudius. They're called procurators. When Pilate is actually governor of Judea, he's called a prefect. But there were reasons why these particular ones were assigned. The proconsuls, as I say, were former senators. They were appointed by the Senate, and they were essentially allowed to appoint proconsuls to senatorial territories, which were these kind of these safe, quiet, pastoral provinces, which were not really strategically important to the emperor. The emperor himself could appoint a prefect over some province which was either strategic in some reason for some way, or it was unstable, or it was in some way, but not to the point that it required an entire legion. And they were often set over newly acquired or rebellious provinces like Judea, for example. And they would have martial or military rule there, and usually the prefect would have some auxiliary, some local military at his disposal. In this case, Pilate, being a prefect, did not have control over a legion, because he was what was called an equestrian governor. He was not a former senator. Only, as I said, the propraetors and the proconsuls were former senators. The prefects were kind of a lower class Roman citizen, and they were essentially Roman knights. They were military men. They weren't administrators like the senators were. Even so, he didn't have the control of a legion. He had essentially auxiliaries there at his disposal in Jerusalem. Beginning in 63 BC, you recall we talked last week or maybe a week before, the city of Jerusalem is captured by Pompey, and he allows Judea to be maintained and managed by the Herods. Herod the Great has essentially the same had in his at his disposal essentially the same power as a proconsul or a proconsul as any of these provincial governors. He essentially was a very kind of a rare exception to the type of power that would be wielded by these provincial by these local kings. I can't think of the name of it. And it's not until 6 A.D. when his sons, Herod Archelaus, and I believe Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, make such a mess out of the administration that Rome has to come and take Judea away from Herod Archelaus. And he puts an actual Roman in charge. These are all, except for Herod the Great, these are all, and Herod Archelaus, obviously, as you see from 4 B.C. to 6 A.D., Archelaus reigns briefly over Judea, essentially in the same power of Herod the Great, his father, but he, as I said, he makes such a mess of it that that these prefects are beginning to be assigned. And as you'll see, Pontius Pilate is considered a prefect. Later on, they'll be called procurators in the reign in the reign of Claudius, but he sometimes, you'll find Pontius Pilate referred to as a procurator, in retrospect. And he essentially had all the power of a procurator, even though he was not a senator, former senator, even though he was an equestrian Roman knight. These other minor, after this point, Archelaus, Antipas, Philip have what is called, they have a lesser title. They're barely called ethnarchs or tetrarchs, rule over a quarter. As I said, or ethnarch would be a national leader or like a rule over a certain race of people, in a sense, an ethnic group. And of course, as we mentioned last week also, I believe, Pontius Pilate takes up residency in Herod the Great's former palace. So Archelaus probably gets booted out, has to move out, and he moves to the Hasmonean Palace, which is kind of between the palace of Herod and the temple. Okay, the three types of Roman magistrates exercised the power of imperium. That's the word that is used to describe their power. And unfortunately, there's not any ancient authority that defines what imperium is, but it basically amounted to the power of total administration and justice and defense and maintenance of the public order with regard to provincials. We'll talk more about the difference between the different types of different status of the population, but essentially it broke down to citizens and provincials, those who were non-citizens, and also slaves below that again, but primarily with regard to provincials. These Roman magistrates, the three main ones that we talked about, the procurator and the propraetor and the proconsul, all had this power of imperium. It was not the same as what is sometimes called the ius gladius, which is the right of the sword. This was used to describe the power that a general had over his citizen army, and it was the power of life or death. You know, a general could have a citizen killed for a citizen in the army. And let's see on the next page here. And there were very few bounds to this power. Essentially, the imperium was an extension of the emperor's imperium, as in the emperor over the empire, the imperial power, the imperia. What did I call it again? Yeah. So. The words all run together essentially, but essentially you can tell by the derivation of the word that it's essentially an extension of the emperor's imperium. And but it was a power in its own right. These rulers did not have to constantly be checking back in with the emperor to see what did you want me to do with this, or what do you want me to do with that, or what should I do with this person. Essentially, it meant that the emperor had the right of veto over their decisions, and not just. Obviously, if he cared, he would tell them, "I didn't like what you did," and it would be a top-down type of of control over these provincial governors. But essentially, as long as they kept the money flowing this way, and they kept the province under control and safe from outside attack, and also safe and stable from interior revolt, the Caesars would be pretty much hands off. So what that meant that is that the bounds on Imperium, the bounds on these provincial governors' power, even though it was even though they were prohibited from extorting and they were prohibited from committing treason, these bounds didn't offer much protection again for provincials, like say for example Jesus, because it relied on a very expensive procedure of accusation, which usually involved sending a delegation, a properly duly authorized delegation, to Rome to complain about the governor. So it was a bottom-up type of a complaint, a bottom-up type of enforcement. It was kind of this enforcement by the provincials themselves. So these governors could be as cruel as they wanted to be, as arbitrary in the enforcement of the laws they wanted to be toward the provincials. And there were no written laws that said how that the governors had to treat these individuals, aside from the extortion and the treason. Okay, the third type, as I said, was the, I don't think we have talked about this yet, that the procurator was actually, or a legate, was actually directly appointed by the emperor again, over territories which were either his personal possession or territories that were particularly large or valuable or had some particular strategic importance. And that was the case of Egypt. Everything that Rome ate in terms of grain came from Egypt. Their entire source of grain came, and toward the end of the empire, that became kind of the albatross around their neck was control of Egypt, and that's why it was so. There was always a legion stationed there, and it was so carefully controlled. And anyway, anytime anybody wants to say anything, it's fine. I'm not trying to run the conversation here. So, the Roman legion. There's a lot that could be said. Again, I'm trying to filter this stuff out, so I'll try to reduce it down. In a speech to the Jews, in an attempt to quell the rebellion, Herod Agrippa observes that the entire Roman Empire is kept under control by only 25 legions. There's variably 25, 28, 30, depending on what point of the empire you're in. But essentially, 25 times approximately 5,000 troops in each legion is how many troops the citizen army amounted to, and that's what kept the entire empire under control. The average Roman legion, as I said, contained 5,500 men, were broken up into 10 cohorts of 500 men each, approximately. The first cohort being a double cohort, and that word cohort is just a reference to these divisions of the legion. Essentially, these are all citizen, this is an entire citizen army. The legions was not permitted to enter mainland Italy. They were not allowed to go into mainland Italy. There was a separate Praetorian Guard that kept and protected Rome and the mainland Italy. By the early empire, each legion is represented by a silver or a bronze aquila or eagle. The various subdivisions or cohorts, as I call them, of the legion would also be represented by a unique standard. So you'd have these separate standards for the different subdivisions. But the eagle would represent the eagle here and the eagle here, the eagle there would represent the actual legion itself. And of course, the name Aquila rings a bell. We recognize that is a Christian name in the epistles, but it means an eagle. And a legion could be severely castigated or disbanded or decimated. Essentially, the literal meaning of decimated was to kill every tenth. The deci, mate, to kill. So a general could have his legion disbanded or decimated for loss of this eagle, for loss of this standard, this unique standard that represented the legion. And it's not like this thing was kept in a box in a safe, you know, back in the office somewhere. This thing was carried around at the front line of battle. And it was actually used as a standard for motivating the men to move forward, motivating the men to fight. In fact, sometimes this the individual, the Aquilifer, who was carrying the Aquila, would leap into the enemy, into the ranks of the enemy. And of course, if the men were afraid, they'd be more afraid of losing this eagle, of losing this standard. And so you can imagine that this person who carried this was a terribly courageous person, a completely unflappable individual. And you'd think that'd be the person you want to give a sword to, that'd be the person you want to have fighting, but this is the person that would motivate these 5,000-some men to retrieve this thing back, to defend it and fight for it. And as you'll see, which will play into a couple of passages that we'll read, these things were essentially abhorred by the Jews, and you can see why. They were essentially just a totem pole of obscenities, in the sense of a Jewish mind. I mean, you know, you have pictures of created things. You have planets and moons and animals, as I said. And you have, beyond that, you have pictures of gods, and you have faces of the emperors as part of the standard. The standard was essentially, you know, a tribute both to the legion and to Rome and to the gods and to Caesar himself. The early legions would have, besides eagles, would have boars, dragons, wolves, horses. But by the early empire, all the legions are represented by the silver eagle or the bronze eagle. Okay, the main component of the Roman legion was, of course, the Roman legionary. As I said, in the early empire, only citizens could serve as legionaries, and non-citizens were attached as auxiliaries, these archers or slingers or lightly armed cavalry. As far as weapons, they would have this pilum, which was essentially this spear which was intended to come apart on impact or to bend on impact so that it couldn't be thrown back. These big shields, the helmet, of course, and the gladius with the sword and the sandals or the shoes, of course, the dress. The skirt. It's thought that the equipment that they had to carry around was about 70 pounds worth of gear when they're on a move. And it would include what you see there, plus whatever gear they had would be strung out on a pole they would carry over their shoulder. And the pole would be used to establish a camp. Every night they would stop and camp. They would dig a ditch and put the dirt on the inside of the ditch, and then they put up these poles. Every single person, 5,000 poles, would stack them up, would put them on top to make a palisade around the top of this ditch. So essentially every night, you know, when the enemy would wake up in the morning, they'd see that the Romans were completely encircled by this wall that they'd built. And then what you also see here is an example on the column of Trajan of the turtle formation or the testudo, where they would use these big broad shields as a protective, it's mobile protective device. Okay.
Chris,
yes, sir.
They had hooks on them so they could hook them together and form a solid shield.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff we could go into, and what we'll do is we'll talk about this again in here before the end if I don't run out of time. Yes, sir.
It
was mostly a voluntary army in the beginning, but it quickly expanded into drafting, into adoption of an extension of citizenship into the citizens into the army and stuff like that. So yes, Shane, I'm sorry.
Thing, just a step back on the standard. I think it's helpful to get some basis of what that is, because so many of the songs that we sing talk about a standard that is before us, mm-hmm. and that is what those songs are referring to, is the rallying point in our battle as we move forward. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the Christians kind of adopted that concept in a more spiritual way, I think. Yes, sir.
I enjoyed watching something in History Channel show about the turtle. It was four men, the way they describe each turtle unit, and the phrase "I've got your back" came from the old turtle. These guys basically backed up each other,
mm-hmm.
and when arrows were incoming, that big shield was placed over their heads.
So and they'd be overlapped, yeah, so they couldn't
penetrate.
They had
a roof over their head that would stop those arrows, and I felt that was so incredibly amazing.
Yeah, I think I've seen video in accounts where they could actually drive a chariot over top of this. It was that strong. They could, you know, you get 30, 40 guys and they're holding this thing up. They can hold up a couple 200-300-400-pound chariot, maybe, you know.
I think it's interesting too that Jesus made a law, or among his people, if they make you walk a mile, which was Roman law, walk an oath for me. Mm-hmm. And from this came the extra mile principle that is widely recognized in business as being the way to go. Mm-hmm. And they had to carry these 70-pound bags.
Well, I don't mention that, but they had had mile markers. That was part of the Roman system. Was every mile they would put a mile marker. So, I guess they would know based on that they had to go to the next marker or not. It was like a 6-foot tall, you know, obelisk at every mile. With regard to Caligula, the emperor, which I won't back up to the to the slide. Josephus says he did so grossly abuse the fortune he had arrived at as to take himself to be a god and to desire to be called so. And he sends Petronius with an army to Jerusalem to place his statues in the temple and commanded him that, in case the Jews would not admit them, he should slay those that oppose it and carry all the rest of the nation into captivity. Petronius takes 3 legions to go down to Jerusalem in about AD 40, 40 AD. This is just 10 years after, essentially after Jesus ascends back into heaven. You can see that the Pax Romana is over for the Jews, essentially. It's ending pretty quickly now. The Jews come out in great numbers with their wives and children into the plain that was by Ptolemais and make supplication to Petronius, first for their own laws and in the next place for themselves. And Petronius is taken back by this. He's got 3 entire legions in the field. And all these people come out and say, look, you can't do this. You can't bring these statues of Caesar into the temple. And when they insisted on their law and the custom of their country and how it was not only permitted and how it was not only not permitted them to make either an image of God or indeed of a man and to put it in any despicable part of their country, much less in the temple of itself, Petronius replied, and am I not also bound to keep the law of my own Lord? For if I transgress and spare you, it is but just that I perish. And while he that sent me and not I will commence a war against you, for I am under command as well as you. And the whole multitude is basically throws himself at his feet and says, look, we're willing to die for this. And Petronius essentially relents. And you have to realize how unlikely and how dangerous this was for him to essentially go against Caligula. We haven't talked anything about the type of person Caligula was, but he wasn't any better than Tiberius, which we talked about to some extent before.
Caligula was insane.
Exactly. Right. And here Petronius is saying, okay, I'm willing to take... Because you're so many, I'm willing to take... He essentially says, I'm willing to die if that's what it takes in order not to make this happen. So at last he got them together and told them that it was best for him to run some hazard himself. For either by the divine assistance, I shall prevail with Caesar and shall myself escape the danger as well as you, which will be the matter of joy for us both, or Caesar will continue in his rage and I will be ready to expose my own life for such a great number as you are. Whereupon he dismissed the multitude who prayed greatly for his prosperity. And he took the army out and he returns back to Antioch. He presently sends a letter to Caesar and informs him of what has happened. And of course, Caesar is completely catatonic with anger. And he writes a letter. Okay, this is where all this stuff comes together now. He writes a letter, Caesar does, ordering Petronius to kill himself. Essentially, his execution. He sends a letter back by ship from Rome back to Jerusalem. Not Jerusalem, but where he would have been in Antioch. But it happened that those who brought Caligula's letter were tossed by a storm and were detained on the sea for 3 months, while others that brought news of Caligula's death had a good voyage. And accordingly, Petronius receives the letter concerning Caius's death 20 days before he receives that letter, which ordered him to kill himself. So, I mean, that's the difference in travel time. It's the difference it's such an amazing story that it's almost providential. One more thing. You recall Tom last week talked about Cestius and his attack on Jerusalem, and we talked about the abomination of desolation and how perhaps that the Roman army standing there outside the gates of Jerusalem represented the abomination of desolation. In AD 66, this is 4 years before, essentially 4 years before the final fall of Jerusalem, in a year or so before Vespasian actually brings the army around and to formally attack the city, the Romans make an attack against the wall for 5 days, Cestius does, with the 12th Legion in AD 66, but to no purpose. But on the next day, Cestius took a great many of his choicest men and with them the archers and attempted to break into the temple at the northern quarter of it. Now, mind you, these legions are carrying these standards, and they're essentially bursting through the temple, bursting into the gate of the temple with these standards, which the people had fallen over themselves not to abide earlier, okay? But the Jews beat them off from the cloisters and repulsed them several times when they were gotten near the wall, till at length the multitude of the darts cut them off and made them retire. But the first rank of the Romans rested their shields upon the wall, and so did those that were behind them, and the like did those that were still more backward, and guarded themselves with what they call testudo, the back of a tortoise, upon which the darts that were thrown fell and slided off without doing them any harm, so the soldiers undermined the wall without being themselves hurt, and got all things ready for setting the fire to the gate of the temple. They essentially were prepared to burst into the temple. And it turns out that for no reason whatsoever, Josephus says, it happened that Cestius was not conscious either of how the besieged despaired of success nor how courageous the people were for him. And so he recalled his soldiers from the place and of despairing, and by despairing of any expectation of taking it, without having received any disgrace, he retires from the city without any reason in the world. Cestius completely backs off, having been right there ready to burst into the city. And he retreats, it turns out, in bad form, and what follows is a complete rout of Cestius and his 12th Legion. And the Jews capture the catapults, they capture the siege engines, they capture, Suetonius says, they capture the standard, and they carry the standard back into Jerusalem. So when you start talking about the abomination of desolation, I think even though the Romans didn't themselves carry it into the city, the Jews themselves most likely carried it back into the city. Josephus says that after this calamity had befallen Cestius, many of the most eminent of the Jews swam away from the city as from a ship when it is going to sink. And that just reminds me of what Jesus says in Matthew 24, 15 through 16. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains.